You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are continuing our history series with Dr. McKenzie today as we learn more about the Puritan movement. Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie. He's professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, helping us take a look at the Puritan movement. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Well, thanks. Nice to be here today with you.
So Charles I takes the throne in 1625. How does he approach his rule differently?
Yeah, Charles inherited from his father a period of disagreements with his parliament. We described what parliament was last time, but was parliament simply an agency of the monarchy? That's the way the monarchs looked at it. Called to endorse or to help the king implement his policies, or was Parliament a partner with the king in developing policies and implementing the policies that the two groups shared? So there's a difference between the two institutions, the monarchy and the Parliament. Furthermore, though we pointed out that the Parliament was called to vote for money that the king needed, the question was then, could the Parliament argue about how that money was going to be spent? Oftentimes the money was intended for warfare, but in this period, the warfare almost always had a strong religious component. England's enemies were Catholic Spain or Catholic France, or were they going to spend money trying to help the Protestant side in the 30 Years' War? So there's this religious dimension to how the money is being spent. Moreover, once Parliament met, then they would have an opportunity to talk about other things that were bothering them, not just how the king wanted to spend his money, but maybe the way religious policy was being set and enforced, or maybe the way royal marriages were being negotiated, or maybe it would be even local concerns. But they wanted to talk about other things besides that which the king wanted them to talk about. And so that was the situation when James died. Charles inherits that, and the situation, for a lot of reasons, goes from bad to worse. At one point, he does agree with the parliamentary faction that they should be supporting the Protestants, the Huguenots in France, but the efforts to support the Huguenots turn out to be a disaster. The British are disgraced in those efforts. And so there's this reaction against the king and his advisors for how badly they had done this. Well, to make a long story short, in 1629, Charles had had it with trying to work with Parliament to raise money, develop and enforce policy. And he sent them home. That's his right. He could do that. He sent them home and did not call for another Parliament for 11 years. From 1629 to 1640, no Parliament. Now, this upset the kind of people who were voted to Parliament, most of them country gentlemen, but these same country gentlemen were also very often Puritans. So they get upset with the king, not only on account of his politics, not using Parliament, but they're also upset with the king about his religious policy. So things start to really boil up and become problematical in both church and politics during the reign of Charles, especially during that decade of the 1630s. So let me talk with you now just a little bit about the religious policy, what was going on in that decade. Well, I think we mentioned this on a previous occasion, that almost from the beginning of his reign, Charles kind of threw in his lot with the anti-Calvinist, the high church, pro-bishop, Arminian faction in the Church of England. And his principal agent for implementing policies that would advance those interests in the Church of England was a bishop in the church by the name of William Laud, who under Charles I was first appointed as Bishop of London, which is kind of like the number two spot in the Anglican hierarchy in these years. And then when George Abbott, the Bishop of Canterbury, finally died in 1633, Laud became the Archbishop of Canterbury. So William Laud is Charles's main man for developing and implementing a church policy that is antithetical to the kinds of doctrines and practices that the Puritans like. Charles found himself in complete agreement with Laud regarding doctrine and church government, and so basically gave Laud carte blanche to do whatever he wanted to in the church. Now, he was not particularly well-liked, but in a monarchical system, you don't have to be liked by everybody. You just have to be liked by one man, that is, namely, the king. So, as long as he had the king's favor, he was able to do what he could to advance the causes in which he believed. He was very deeply appreciative of the Book of Common Prayer, but even more than that, he thought that the unity of the Church of England depended upon conformity to the Book of Common Prayer. In other words, if the Church of England was ever going to be united, overcome its divisions and so forth, everybody had to worship on the same page. He said this much later, after the Civil War had started and he was actually in prison. He said, "Ever since I came in place as Archbishop, I labored nothing more than that the external worship of God, too much slighted in most parts of this kingdom, might be preserved, and that with as much decency and uniformity as might be, being still of the opinion," and here's the bottom line, "that unity cannot long continue in the church where uniformity," think uniformity of worship, "is shut out at the church door." So he really wanted then the Book of Common Prayer, its ceremonial regulations, to be practiced all over the Church of England. His predecessor, George Abbott, had been really sloppy on that. And he had let things go, and all over the place you had pastors who weren't wearing the required vestments, weren't forcing people to kneel when they took communion, weren't wearing the kind of robe that you were supposed to. And so you had all these kinds of deviations from regular church practice, which Laud said, well, now we're going to enforce. And he actually meant it. One of the practices that he revived was that of metropolitan visitation. Now, let me back up for a second. Bishops from the days of the Middle Ages and into the Reformation period in a place like England were supposed to conduct visits of all the parishes in their churches to make sure that the pastors were behaving, that the people were being taught, that the churches were being taken care of, just to make sure that everything was going the way it should. But that was a bishop's job. Well, Law decided to make it an archbishop's job. For the first time in 100 years, the archbishop decided to conduct visitations of all of the churches. So all throughout England, inquiries were made regarding the state of play in the cathedrals and churches. What services were being held? How were the pastors dressing? Were they performing according to the rules and regulations of the Book of Common Prayers? And when they weren't, Laud took efforts to make them toe the line. Now, how did he make them toe the line? Well, there were regular church courts that could be used, but these church courts were old-fashioned, inefficient, kind of got hung up with medieval red tape, so they didn't work very well. Well, what Laud did was to make use of what was called a prerogative court. And a prerogative court was a court that derived directly from the king's power and could develop more modern and efficient ways of dealing with things. And in the Church of England, they had, prior to Laud, for several decades, a Court of High Commission. And this Court of High Commission, Laud used, especially to go after people who had power and authority on a local level. Because now this, at an upper level, with this court, that Laud himself could preside over or be a member of, along with other high members of the church and state, they could go after the kind of people that ordinary church courts would find it difficult. So the Court of High Commission, acting in, as kind of a not only a court but also a prosecuting agency, went after people that otherwise could not be gone after, and treated them rather fiercely. I'm going to give you a couple of examples here, some funny, some not so funny. One of those that Laud decided he had to deal with was a bishop, the Bishop of Lincoln. His name was John Williams. And he was not a particularly pro-Puritan or pro-Calvinist, but he was one of these guys who let things slide. So when he was asked, for example, to give a report about how things were going in his diocese, he wrote back a two-word answer, omnia bene, everything's fine, everything's fine. That was his report, everything's fine. Well, everything was not fine as far as Laud was concerned. And so Williams was brought up on charges that had to do with, kind of a relatively trivial matters about how things were being organized, money was being spent, etc. But Williams didn't like it. And so what he did was try to bribe jurors so they could get out from under these charges. And that really got him into trouble, as a result of which this very powerful bishop was suspended from office and thrown into the Tower of London. So this kind of demonstrated that Laud, when he wanted to, could go after and get anybody. And he did. He went after and he got some rather important people. Now, I want to point out some of those that he had gotten to. But before I do, let me just pause here and see if I'm making sense to you folks.
Yeah, all of the... It's amazing how much division starts to really creep in, and all, how all of the religion and the politics are all very closely tied together. And that can be a little bit difficult. When I've talked about this before on the Ladies Lounge podcast of religion and politics during this time, it's a little hard for us to, as Americans, to maybe fully grasp how closely related religion and politics are with all of these state churches. So it's interesting to understand that more fully in England. And it is time for us to take our break. So we'll come back to that list of people after this break. We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the church at the time of Charles I in England, his political policies, his religious policies, all of these issues that were going on during this time with the Archbishop Laud, and all of these, his courts and the people that he was going after. And before we went to break, you were going to give us a list of some of the people that he had gone after.
Yeah, I'm going to do this in two ways. First of all, I should back up and be a little bit more specific about some of the things that he wanted in orderly worship and that he insisted upon and that the Puritans particularly objected to. Now, some of these things you can hardly think that somebody would object to, but Laud, in his visitation, discovered some things that just horrified him. A lack of reverence in the conduct of church service generally, but one church building had cockfights on the Tuesday before Lent. Another place had pigeon shoots in the building. Another place had lead, had the roof melted down for the lead so it can be used for other things.
Oh my.
Yeah, now these are oddly extreme cases. Much more typical was the fact that men brought dogs with them into church, and those dogs would do what dogs do, and then they used the communion table as kind of a hat rack. Well, all of this was just appalling to Laud. He wanted much more reverence and wanted much more respect, especially for the sacrament. And so he gave the order that communion tables were supposed to be put against the east end of the chancel. Now, the east end of the chancel is where altars in the medieval church were placed. So the Puritan mind is he's turning the communion table back into a medieval altar. He also insisted that the altar needed to be protected by a communion rail. And he specified how high it had to be and how thick it had been, and dogs couldn't get through it. Well, okay, but now this is where people are going to be kneeling for communion. So again, the Puritan mind says, well, now he wants to have a communion rail around this altar, just like they did in the Middle Ages. He also insisted not only that the preachers wear the surplice, which was objectionable to the Puritans, but he also insisted that they bow at the name of Jesus during their service. And that was something new. And again, they thought of this as kind of artificial and Catholic, if you will. So these are the things that he's insisting upon. These are the things that are bothering them. And there were men in the church who had, some of them had fairly long careers, others were kind of new, who just did not think in good conscience that they could go along with all of this stuff. The surplice, the bowing, the kneeling, they just objected to those things. And so he went after them and started depriving them of their livings. And now here's my point. A number of those men ended up going to America. It's really during the period of Charles' personal reign, between 1630 and 1643, 20,000 Englishmen migrated to New England, where they established colonies in Massachusetts and Connecticut that were religious colonies. Their leaders were men, laymen, who had been offended by Laud and his policies. And there are some other things that we'll talk about too, but the political things as well as the religious things. And then there were a number of clergy who were gone after by Laud, and some had been deprived of their positions. Others were being called up before the Court of High Commission. And so they left too. So Thomas Hooker, who was the great founder of the Connecticut colony, John Cotton. And Cotton was very interesting. He had been for like 25 years a preacher in St. Butolph's in Boston and Lincolnshire. He's kind of the most famous Puritan preacher of the day. Well, he was not big on wearing the surplice, so Laud went after him, and he did not stick around to get tried and deprived. He left for Massachusetts before that would happen. So Laud's policies are driving good, respectable clergy and lay people who belong to the Puritan wing that had been doing just fine under George Abbott, but now find themselves under Laud being persecuted and, in a sense, being driven out of England in order to start these colonies on the other side of the Atlantic. Now, I'm going to come back to them in a little bit, but just let me say this about them. They're not separatists. They are Puritans. And so what they do in New England is try to establish the Church of England the way they think it should be. So it's still going to be a national church, but it's not going to look like Laud's church. It's going to be a church that is run, operates, and worships according to the right standards instead of the wrong one. So that's one thing that happens. Going back to England and some of the people that Laud is going after. Now here I've got to introduce yet another feature of the concerns here. While Laud is enforcing things which to the Puritan clergy and lay look Catholic, and while people like Richard Montagu, the promoter of Arminianism and the rejecter of Calvinism, people like him are being appointed to high positions in the church, bishops and the like, at court, there is actually now a Catholic chapel, Catholic worship. I think on a previous episode I mentioned this, but if not, it's worth remembering, that right at the beginning of his reign, Charles married the daughter of the French king. Her name was Henrietta Maria. She's the daughter of a French king, and she's the sister of the reigning French king, Louis XIII. And a part of the deal for the marriage was that she would be allowed to maintain her Catholicism in England. So the Queen of England is a practicing Catholic. This, in turn, prompted some of the leading English ladies to convert to Catholicism, to kind of, you know, get in with the Queen. And that was known. And so the Puritans see this kind of Catholic worship, Catholic-leaning bishops, and Catholics at court, and they start to view this all as kind of a big conspiracy to return England to Catholicism. And this is close enough to the Reformation period and close enough to the Spanish Armada and so forth, is that they see this as a real threat, not only to their faith, but also to their nation. The king is not using parliament. He's hanging around with the French. The French are developing absolute monarchy. They're beating up on continental opponents. So it's a scary time for the Puritan Calvinist movement or wing in the Church of England. And there is some criticism that this is generating. And Laud goes after his domestic critics. And there's a couple of very famous ones that I am going to try to mention here. It was in 1630, the early 1630s, that a Puritan lawyer by the name of William Prynne started to write against what he considered the moral decadence of his day. The bishops who permitted May games, dancing, pictures and organs in the churches, the court people who were involved in all kinds of sexual dalliances, divorces, and the like. This all offended him greatly. And so he wrote against it. And in one particular work, he went after drama, stage plays, and everything associated with them. His timing was bad, though, because his book came out precisely when the Queen herself was acting in a play. Whereas Prynne's index had this particular item, women actors, notorious whores. Theaters, he wrote, were the devil's chapels. Well, this got him into trouble. And he was hauled before one of these prerogative courts, and they condemned him to the pillory, cropping his ears, imprisonment for life, and a 5,000 pound fine. Prynne retaliated with more pamphlets. And along with John Bastwick, a physician, and Henry Burton, a clergyman, all of whom were tried for the same thing, their criticism of the elite, the bishops, and so forth, they were all three condemned. to this life imprisonment, and in fact were branded on their faces with the letters SL for seditious libeler. Prynne, however, called his SL the stigmata laudis, the wounds of laud. They were publicly humiliated and brought to prison, but it was just an outstanding episode because these were respectable people. You didn't treat respectable people who were not notorious lawbreakers like this. And some people, Puritan types, treated them almost as martyrs, trying to get their handkerchiefs wet with their blood so that they had the sacred symbol of these guys. Anyway, Laud is doing stuff like this, and it is not helping the public imagery of the church when he goes after people who are respectable and who were critical of things that most Puritan Calvinist Christians thought were bad also. So things during this period of 11 years, there's lots of stuff in the church that is upsetting people. There's lots of stuff in the ways that Charles is trying to raise money that are upsetting people. And the thing is boiling up, and we are getting to a point of crisis, as we will see when we get to the Scottish Rebellion. But I'm not sure if we got time to do that.
We are out of time for today, but we can take that on next time.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
Very good. The Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you so much, Dr. McKenzie, for being our guest today. Looking forward to next time.
Good. So am I.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.